Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Casey Coar Show, a celebration of words. I'm honored today to have as my guest Wyatt Prunty. And Mr. Prunty is going to read some of his poetry today. And one of my missions is to give a voice to American poetry. And I think the most effective way to do that is to hear poets read their work aloud. I first heard Mr. Prunty read his poetry in 1995 and was moved by the beauty of the poems, the era in which many of them are set, the stories that surround the poems, and his picture of life in America, particularly in the South. And without anything further from me, I'd like to introduce Wyatt Prunty. And the first poem he's going to read is called The Last Century. Welcome, Wyatt. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell me a little bit about the poem Last Century. This, I understand, you have not published as of yet. Is that correct?
It's forthcoming in the Virginia Quarterly. It'll be out this fall. It was just accepted before the Writers' Conference. But I was making a study of Margaret Bourke White, and I was also thinking about our various times when we're at war. And in some ways, it's easier to write about an earlier war than a contemporary one. There's a little distance and objectivity provided by that, if, in fact, some of the problems that you see in the earlier war are similar or the same as the problems, similar to or the same as the problems you see in the current war. So I had two or three things in mind. Margaret Bourke White was very courageous as a photographer. That is, she had a great deal of physical courage as well as artistic courage. And that led her to taking these spectacular shots from high points on buildings under construction, shots from airplanes flying over combat zones, bombed out cities during World War II. She also was, this is not in the poem, but she took pictures of assembly lines and things that were coming down the assembly line and found shapes and lighting that were quite beautiful that you would not expect, and so transformed things that were utilitarian into something more than that. There's also mention of Walker Evans in this poem just in passing, and he, of course, worked with James Agee to create a very famous book about the Dust Bowl poor. Mainly, it was it was 2000 or a little after 2000, and I was looking back when I first started thinking about writing the poem. I had a little bit of it in manuscript, and then 9/11 came, and I thought I want to do more with that. It's a survey of at least something I think that was fairly characteristic of the last century. Yeah.
Thank you. So now we're going to hear The Last Century.
Last century. Last century, we took a lot of shots of what we did, framing things for look and life, so we could see us and our lot riveting the lattice of a skyline or walking the I-beams of infinite rooms over Manhattan, Cleveland, and Washington. Oh, elevated light. We were amassing works, bridges and dams, Ikes, interstates, high-rises, raising tons out of a continent unfolding by mountain and pit, plain and gradient river, the convex sky bottling cirrus highs and the steep cumuli of moody weather, O century of light. Back then we were stout realists, working out all manner of the world as one to one. The aerials that Margaret Bourke White got of factories and bombed out towns. Also the gaunt subtractive stares by Evans, whose dust bowl pour became our luminous internal weather. And then in Buchenwald there were the faces of ourselves, fed guards, starved Poles and Jews, the citizens of Weimar just trucked in, bearing the stares of deformed children, as now our lenses focused on the creel and undertow of the swallowing real weather of enlightenment. Add in atomic white, the napalm blind, an overbright disequilibrium had settled in, a kind of countermind, blind as those guards at Buchenwald, dark room and looking up, gashed faces wide with fear, all interrogatives frozen where someone holds a light for focusing Margaret Bourquite, while the two guards, deserving or not, stripped to bloody underwear, still looking up in horror at what's coming next here, pop, thanks to the flash, so everyone will see us taking our turn at victory, oh century. There's a little refrain at the end of each stanza. It either works or it does not work, but it alludes to weather and light over and over again. And I think that another thing I wanted to get out of the poem was the way the Enlightenment, the religious wars in Germany, Romanticism, the way these things still are with us, were certainly with us during World War II, and they continue to be with us in terms of various kinds of divisions.
So. Thank you. That I'm delighted to hear that that's going to be in the Virginia Review, and look forward to picking up a copy of that when it is released. We're going to take a short break here on the Casey Kohar Show, A Celebration of Words, and we'll be right back with Wyatt Prunty. Good afternoon. Welcome back to the Casey Kohar Show, A Celebration of Words. Our guest today is Wyatt Prunty. And the next selection we're going to hear from Mr. Prunty is called The Water Slide Along the Beach. And I heard this poem a couple of nights ago, and I think it is not only a delightful poem, well-structured, and Wyatt might tell us a little bit about the poem before he reads it.
Well, if you see it on the page, the first two stanzas are in ordinary type, and then the next five are in italics, and then the last two are ordinary again. The idea being that there's one perspective, a perspective at one distance on the subject, and then a slightly telescoped perspective that takes place starting with the third stanza and explores what it has to say. This is a poem that I would not have written without our two children, who are grown now, but at the time were small and on a vacation and insistent for something they thought they wanted, and then they decided they did not want. And meanwhile, there was the role of the parents and the observation of the parents, and perhaps a conclusion at the end of the poem. So you want me to go ahead and read it?
Please.
Yeah. The Water Slide Along the Beach. It is someone's mimicry, the clockworks of wave and tide and shifting weather, which, when filled and turned on, makes rhythmical the textured and turquoised edge of our stilled gulf. Ages 10 and 7, they beg to go, and so we take them, swayed backs, taut bellies poking forward like impudence. They are brown enough to be ripe or cooked. And symmetrical as the conchs they find, always with the same exclamations, the small empty shells they see as beautiful because they echo the one who listens. It is the blood's cliched continuum traveling from ear to shell to ear again that reassures them of their small full seas, the long grays and blues that wait ahead for them, the tides that will rise for their departures or that will drop, leaving their hulls mired and leaning, and promised vessels passing out of sight, topping the horizon, where, briefly magnified, they disappear beyond the wavy plain of humane endurance, in which we think the gulls cry with almost human voices, think the stark similes of looking out. The ships depart, flags fade, the ships go down, down the round that even children know about, where China is not reached by pick or shovel, only where the lens quits and the eye blinks shut. Now our nut brown pairs at the top, they are waving, We wave encouragement. Racing down, they bounce, spin, and scream laughter. Helped out, their wet hands leave wide prints. They drip, wipe noses, rush off, demanding that we watch. As if those most powerful ever let us drop our eyes from where they see us magnified, topping their horizons.
Thank you. I love that poem. Wyatt, when I've heard you read your poetry, it seems to me that both your father and your father-in-law have had a great influence on you as both a man and a poet. And if you would, before we read your next poem, would you tell me a little bit about the influence of those two men in your life and how it shaped your poetry?
Well, my father was a geographer. He went to school during the Depression and went from university to graduate school at Clark University, where he had a fellowship in geography, and he received his PhD just as World War II broke out. He was stationed in Athens, Georgia, to teach meteorology to Navy pilots. Initially, his first assignment was to do high altitude aerial photography for mapping, for cartography over Germany. But they figured out he had a PhD, so they thought it was more appropriate to put him in the classroom. And I suppose I'm glad they did do that, because I don't think his life expectancy would have been so great if he had been in the air over Germany. Mm-hmm. He was there in Athens doing that, and my father-in-law was over in Atlanta learning to fly. My father was invited back to Athens, Georgia, to the University of Georgia after the war, and his specialty was the South. It was soil composition and southern agriculture and settlement patterns and things like that. So it made sense for him to go back there as opposed to some other places that he considered. And we grew up in this small college town in the South, which was in the middle of a culture that had not yet changed, really, but because it was a university town, it had changed, or was changing anyway, not as fast as it should have been, perhaps, but certainly in one area it was not as fast as it should have been. Nevertheless, it was an interesting place to grow up, and he would take his graduate students on field trips. So as a child, I would go on those field trips, and it would be an all-day lecture, basically. We would travel across middle Georgia up into north Georgia and stop periodically, and he would discuss one or another feature of the landscape and so forth. So that I had the impression as a child and into teenage years that everything could be explained. You know, there were no questions that couldn't be answered because he seemed to know everything. On trips, if I asked him something, we would be going along and he would say, well, that's a basin over there, or that's a sink, he would say. And I would say, well, what is a sink? And he would light a cigarette. This was, of course, the 50s when everybody smoked, which meant, you know, he was going to talk a while, and my older sister would hit me on the back of the head for doing this, and then we would listen to this monologue. So that was one thing, and the whole enterprise of the geographer, they bring so many disciplines together. Going back to von Humboldt, who's really the father of modern geography, the enterprise is at once humanistic and scientific. It's quite romantic in a way. It is an ideal discipline, I think, for America or Americans, because it does seek to synthesize and bring things together in a way that we as a melting pot and as the center of the Industrial Revolution and scientific and technological development and social development in a way that we've carried out our history. But that's one thing from my father, and a love for the land, the landscape, and he looked after some small farms, not big farms, but did quite well with those that were from my mother's side of the family. Then my father-in-law was from Long Island and in New York City, and got caught up in the war and flew for the Navy in the Pacific. I never talked much about, neither of them really talked a whole lot about the military, but as I got older and I had to go into the Navy too at one point, I looked back on what they had done with growing appreciation, My father-in-law at one point managed to put a bomb on an enemy cruiser, and to hear him tell it, he was not looking for a fight at all and didn't know he was over the fleet until they shot at him. It was at night, and he said he was like a goose evacuating. He said, "Why they shot at me, and I lost my bomb." But in fact, that wasn't true. He was highly decorated, and he did a lot of things. And I think the thing I admired most about him was he could have come back from the war and from many other hardships he had as a young man in his family with the Depression and so forth. He could have taken a stern look at things and had a rather substantial scowl on his face, I think, and he did just the opposite. And life was, therefore, pretty much the opposite when you were in his presence. And so there was a kind of courage there to make things, to do the best you could with what was available. And he did well with many different things. So they were both a wonderful company, mm-hmm. and sources of great information, and they were great examples.
Yes, it's that comes through, I think, in your poems. There's the respect and a reverence of that generation, I think, that is very, very well versed. Let's shift gears a little bit here, and you wrote a poem entitled Late Walks, and when you introduced the poem the other evening here at the Sewanee Writers Conference, you talked about a friend of yours who had cancer, and I was very moved by the poem because so many of us in the world we live today have been touched by someone who's had cancer, and this particular woman seemed to have touched something in you that inspired you to write this poem.
Yeah, this is a particular individual, but I had several in mind. One of the things that I think goes with this poem that many people experience is that typically, at least up until now things are changing perhaps, but the pattern, at least for most of my life, has been that the men die earlier and the women have to carry on, and I think that many of them spend a great deal of time by themselves, and yet they have children and grandchildren often, and they it takes a lot of courage to face things by yourself. It also takes a lot of courage to, you become the repository, I think, of family lore, and you become an example of why people should carry on and look forward to more years instead of despairing. So there's I don't think we quite catch it as often as I don't think we catch it as often as we should, at any rate, catch the fact that there is a profound role played by people who apparently are frail and even to a degree perhaps are require our help, but in fact they champion their life, and they champion our lives, and they show us reasons for continuing, and they establish a kind of value. It takes a great deal of courage. So this was just somebody who not only had cancer but had a heart failure, and you never felt sorry for her because she had such pluck, such courage. It's entitled Late Walks. Health was a brutally exclusive neighbor with windows overlooking one-way streets where visits were brisk turns about soul topics that either improved or did not, where hope collected like some prospect of mass mailings or the gloved applause of pigeons lifting. Before she was sick, she said she didn't know what health was anyway, a free mortgage. Carrying what now had grown too heavy, I listened to her lyric of losses, diminishment sharpened, as sun astringent as the clearing where she drank air, praised light.
Thank you. Our guest today is Wyatt Prunty. We've been enjoying his poetry. And this one I kind of slid in on Wyatt. I didn't tell him beforehand that I was going to ask him to read it, but it's one of my favorites, and it is in the new and selected poems titled Unarmed and Dangerous, which is published by John Hopkins Press, who I believe, Wyatt, they've published
All of my poetry, and Oxford University has published a collection of criticism, and then there's Sewanee Writers on Writing from LSU Press.
Yes, so to learn more about Mr. Prunty, just go online. All of his books are available from John Hopkins Press, and the most recent, which he's reading from right now, is titled Unarmed and Dangerous. So this is a favorite of mine, and I'll let Mr. Prunty tell you about it and read the poem for us.
Okay, well, this is entitled The Depression, The War, and Gypsy Rose Lee. It's a description of a marriage, and it's a little offbeat, I think, and has a different stride to it from some of my poems, and so I enjoy it for that reason. But I think that the world that it collects is probably what recommends it the most. It has a quotation from Gypsy Rose Lee to start it off. H.L. Mencken called me an ecdysiast. I've also been described as deciduous. The French call me a déhabilleuse. In less refined circles, I'm known as a stripteaser. In a photograph now left to me, two people lock their arms and pose, leaning against a car's black boxy side, cigarettes held out, eyes squinting. My parents smile into the sun, so close their white clothes blur into one image. It's 1938. Most things are cheap and unaffordable. The war ahead, with money to spend and nothing to buy, ready as any substitute to draft people from part-time jobs to a full-time hitch, and anonymous as orders through the mail, or targets that synchronize with calendars and newsreels ticking black and white. Soon things will be standardized. The prefab buildings, starched uniforms, haircuts, and requisitioned tires. Even the big band sound on radios whose dials illuminate the stilled faces of those listening for news between two coasts darkened against attack. Traveling west at 45, my parents will drive at night to duck the heat and save the rationed recap tires that peel their tread regardless what. Promises, all California long. Belief, an exhausted Chevrolet with running boards and rings gone bad. They call it Gypsy Rose Lee because it's only got the bare essentials. But takes them out answering orders by traveling nights and sleeping days. Helps detour them through one dull rental after another for 5 years. Later, an academic life. They lose one child, have three more. Progress. Until the body's fractions add up against its certainties. Sometimes a radio left on all night because the weather's hot and still. No one can sleep, but no one talks either. Or a dog barks at a car passing too slowly to be going anywhere but home. So late that being late doesn't matter anymore. Sometimes necessity becomes its own dwindling fact, like the stripper's need for money, whose name they gave their car, a joke to reconcile them to the things they wanted then but couldn't have, like Kilroy, who only wanted to go home. And beyond necessity, some hope for other things, put in the names they gave their children to each other, and the explanations handed their children, because explaining things becomes a way of naming them also. Locked arms to pose a photograph, surviving all these two survived, no hint of what they saw ahead making them smile, except the camera's implicit place, circular and reflecting out of its own dark precision, dark like the theaters where people sat taking in short censored newsreels and narrow as the wised-up Cold War that followed. Shadowing the corny jokes on television, canned laughter over whiz bombs, trick ties with lights blinking across the 50s, one whoopee cushioned sigh of relief. Like the relief reckoned by Gypsy Rose Lee, writing her memoirs in 1955, addressing them to her son, and counting everything she owned, enumerating respectability, the Rolls with matching luggage, the house in New York on East 63rd, complete with pool and elevator. Some little things removed, some big ones gathered up. One innocence erodes another, with neither one accurate in what it pushes forward like a handbill or cart loaded with incidentals, and no one cautions against the little things adding up in closets and storage rooms to another set of incidentals building toward one solemn rummage sale held after the last big fire and funeral in everybody's yard. But casual now, as a part-time worker taking orders, or soldier on temporary duty, casual as someone sick who's left alone, dozing among the pastel cards well-wishers have sent. A several and sad innocence, that spot an audience will watch when a magic trick takes place, distraction made unique yet shared and similar to the way you tighten inwardly to smile or seem natural when someone takes your picture. The day brought down to one approximation, leaving each one a little foolish, like a naked man whose navel's full of lint. But in this photograph that's left to me, it's 1938. Everything is ahead, like something on a map that someone reads in a car at night, the road jostling a flashlight so the map is hard to figure out, this picture that they leave, the one I find, which now becomes a photograph I take of someone photographing me, cameras zoomed into each other, two lenses fix on interiors that stop down to blank shutters cutting part to smaller part, like mirrors set in a barber shop facing their diminishing reflections. Even diminishment provides a kind of movement, an always falling, like motion sickness, but felt the way an overloaded plane lifts off, then doesn't climb, but runs for miles, barely above the trees, until gathering speed, the nose tilts up, and looking back, you feel yourself dropping away through what you see.
I love that poem. Thank you, Wyatt. We're going to take a short break here. You're listening to the Casey Coar Show, a celebration of words. We'll be right back. And Mr. Prunty has agreed to read one more poem for us. This one is a little more lighthearted. And we'll end the show on that note when we return from this short break. Welcome back to the Casey Coar Show, a celebration of words. We've been privileged today to have Wyatt Prunty reading his poems. And the last poem that we're going to hear today is another personal favorite of mine. And as the years go by, I can relate to this poem a little more comfortably, perhaps, than I like. But I think that most of the listeners will be able to relate to the poem which Mr. Prunty is going to read for us.
The poem is entitled Recovery, and it's about, athletic injuries coming back to haunt you. They may not be all athletic injuries, just maybe the result of getting a little older. The interesting thing is that at least one of the ailments complained about, described by the poem, presented itself to me after I finished the poem. So I'm not going to write any more complaints. I don't want another visit. This is entitled Recovery. That elbow with its pinpoint bruise just where the ligament tore loose, or herniated disc pancaked sideways and threatening to stay that way. So you're a sorry mannequin for clothes who, bending stiffly down to hoist his bags, stays put until the comedy allows that someone bend to bend you up again. And then bone spur knuckled into nerve so arm shoots pain and fingers numb, or spasm through the neck so head clocks down, stilled in rigid compensation. Gimp knee, arthritic toe, a touch of gout and off you go, but differently until gout gone you tiptoe after. That is the mystery by which the late pain walks a later floor, answers each new step, and punctuates tomorrow's tense as with the ribs, caught breath, carved shape, or emphysema quantifying stairs, so every step's a calisthenic now collected on its miniature abyss. Where the crooked elbow can't unbend, and arm goes only so much high, where the football knee that never kneels unhinges and rehinges equally, where winter long the twisted spine perfects its coat, as all my life I thought shape shrouded form and form was full, but where we wince as though called back, we hollow how we go.
Thank you. If I may ask, I hope it wasn't the gout that you wrote about and then experienced.
Wasn't gout. It was better than that, although who knows, that may be waiting in the future.
Well, I hope not. I had it once and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. Our guest today has been Wyatt Prunty, and he's been reading primarily from Unarmed and Dangerous, which is, as I mentioned, is published by John Hopkins Press. And I'd like to thank Mr. Prunty for being our guest today, and I hope that you've enjoyed hearing poetry read aloud. And so let's have a final comment by Mr. Prunty, and then join us next week for another session of the Celebration of Words with Casey Coars.
Well, I would just say that there are many wonderful poets writing today. Some of them passed through Sewanee. Many of them have passed through Sewanee, and I would encourage people to go to their bookstores and or get online and check out some of the online magazines like Blackbird, and where they can hear people reading, but also buy the books and see. This is a great time for poetry in America.
I agree. Thank you very much, Wyatt.
Thank you.